they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you.
RadioGorgeous.com.
I'm welcoming to Radio Gorgeous the author of Sympathy, Olivia Sujic. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for having me.
Introduce us to the book Sympathy, so that it's your words and I don't give away too much.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've gone over quite a few different iterations of my explanation. I feel like it wasn't until the book actually got published that I feel like I can now say what it's about, which is a bit too late. So in my words, I guess, it's about a girl who graduates, has that experience that a lot of us can relate to of not knowing what to do next, not knowing how to give shape to your life, decides to go to New York, where she has discovered she has a grandmother she didn't really know anything about. And whilst there, the idea is that she's going to try to find a job, find out what to do with herself, discover more about her identity and her past. And instead, she discovers a Japanese writer living in New York whose life, my protagonist, who's called Alice, starts to sort of feel has strange parallels or some kind of odd significance in relation to her own. Instead, therefore, of finding herself, she kind of becomes almost someone else or many selves. And it's about really how she gets lost with these kind of online personas, which is, I mean, I guess it's about a lot of things, but I guess identity is the main thing.
I felt the protagonist, it's a specific time in her life. And I think in that moment, as you say, you're supposedly waiting for life to begin in some way. And for her, I think past hurts and past traumas, she's managed to deal with those until she's at this moment. And they all sort of come crowding into her.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I think certain people perhaps who haven't experienced any of those or similar past traumas might not recognize them as such. I think, you know, certain men of a certain age, perhaps some of those traumas are perhaps a little bit invisible. But I think to anyone who's experienced something similar to what Alice has in her quite murky past, when she no longer has an institution or a structure that keeps her sort of in one piece, as it were, she begins to kind of fragment. The second that she's almost free to make her own choices and to decide for herself who she wants to be when she's no longer at school or university or with a kind of slightly dysfunctional family, her past, which is vague to say the least, she has been displaced and adopted and then kind of taken in by various people and moved around the globe in a kind of very haphazard way, which means I think she's looking for meaning, she's looking for significance, she's kind of portent hungry, you might say, to kind of find things that shine out and make her feel like, yes, this is who and where you are supposed to be. But I think you're right, it's actually at that moment, which is a kind of privilege in some ways for lots of people, to be able to choose who you want to be and no longer be constrained. Actually, it was those constraints that were kind of holding her together. And so I think when she arrives in New York and, you know, suddenly she's confronted by all this seeming choice, she's quite paralyzed by it at first. And then there are sort of certain things which she uses to try and recreate some of that institutionalized sort of shape that she used to have, like using the street grid of New York to be like, am I going left or right, up or down? And that ends up being what gives her day's shape at first. Then it ends up being this Instagram grid, which replaces the city grid almost, but kind of overlays it in a way. And this sort of Instagram persona of this elder writer, Japanese woman living in New York, becomes who she uses as a kind of mold, if you like, to kind of keep her in a set form. The point at which I think those past traumas really get a hold and threaten to totally kind of disintegrate what little identity she appears to have is when that woman disappears and when she's locked out of that sort of social media sort of, I guess, framework, which I think to somebody perhaps who grew up offline and who doesn't have that as a very integral daily glue of you know, of their life, doesn't perhaps quite understand the way it's not just a neutral medium. It's become something that really does shape us. And I feel like I wanted to explore how this in the story in a way could have taken place in any age and with any form of technology. I just wanted to look at how whatever technology we create ends up shaping us back in return. And perhaps unlike in previous ages, where if you think of the prefix like Iron Age, Stone Age, you know, Steam Age, with the Internet Age, I don't think our ethical frameworks, our moral understanding has really caught up. The human understanding and intelligence hasn't really caught up with the speed at which that technology moves. So I think there's this void, and it's exactly that point at which her more traditional markers of identity, such as family, such as race, such as origins, really start to make her feel like a blur, like a kind of invisible, perhaps slightly exploited person. So yes, I think it's quite a dark book.
Yes, it's a bit dystopian.
Yes, I definitely think that I didn't set out with any particular moral or didactic kind of idea in mind, other than perhaps to question a utopian technological view of how, you know, I remember once encountering a character who's a little bit like Dwight, who is her boyfriend in the book, and is basically a kind of tech bro. And he has this mantra, basically, that technology is a force for good. And I just sort of wanted to say, is it? I mean, it's a force, that's for sure, but it can be a force for anything, whatever we want to use it for. And I guess I wanted to look at that kind of sinister side of it, the side that perhaps is how it affects our mental health, how it affects, yes, our relationships with other people, but also I saw the relationship between Alice and the elder writer, Mizuko, almost as a metaphor in a way for each of our own individual relationships with the internet itself, like how we are kind of addicted to it, followed by it, how, you know, Google marketers kind of take the equivalent of a kind of pound of flesh off us every time we click, search, like, use, and that information ends up making this kind of ghostly picture, this sort of ghost twin of ourselves online, which sort of follows us around and nudges our choices and powers algorithms that we don't even understand. And I'm the first person to say I wrote this book not understanding how this technology works, and that is exactly why I feel like the majority of people like me use it uncritically, unthinkingly. There's a lot of kind of pseudo sociological journalism out there, which this isn't what I'm trying to do. I wanted to look specifically at fiction to see how it really affects our personalities, ourselves, our relationships.
Well, it's interesting that you say, let's take the Industrial Age, for example. You know, we do see it from this perspective. It was great. Well, it couldn't have been done without slave labor.
Yeah, so, exactly.
You know,
like, exactly.
If someone had to get the iron out of...
That double bind, exactly, of how, you know, and it's the same with the construction of New York. That mm-hmm. wouldn't have happened without bondage and, you know, the
child
people
labor.
Actually, exactly,
and,
the people who build the things. You know, there's always this trade-off. In the case of the internet, I feel like the main trade-off is sort of between privacy and convenience.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
You know, everyone else is on it. You kind of have to use it. I know people, for example, with Facebook who are only on it to remain hyper-vigilant against being posted in things they don't want to be, you know, a Facebook memory from 10 years ago with an ex that you'd really rather did not appear on your timeline. So you're kind of on it merely to monitor, to be a bit paranoid, to be vigilant. And then, you know, in return, yes, you can use your Google Maps to get somewhere quite easily, or you can, you know, get, an Uber somewhere. But I feel like gradually people are starting to feel like what once made them feel powerful and had this sense of mastery is now almost becoming...
Manipulative,
exactly. And who's really in control? And I guess there's this feeling that, and I looked at that through things like the New York grid and the kind of the idea of this motherboard underneath everything, which we don't really understand, and we don't really know what information it has about us. This metadata, which is sort of like skin or hair or kind of dust specks of us, that's littered everywhere in this kind of digital breadcrumb trail online. But it's people in Palo Alto who are mainly male and definitely, you know, not representative of society as a whole, they're the ones who speak the language, who can code, who know how to basically follow you around with a suggestion of a sofa you might like from based on preferences you've had 2 years ago, or they know you're pregnant perhaps before you do, all that kind of stuff based on what you search for, or so on and so forth. And I felt like that creepy feeling I had, that not understanding feeling, was something I wanted to kind of push on and examine why it is that something I use every day is sort of so opaque to me.
Yes, as you say, it could have been set at any time, because a lot of the things that occur and that are so compelling to Alice and to other people in the story, the idea that we do want to connect to stories that are bigger than us, you know, where were you the day JFK died? Yes. Well, why would that even be important, you know? But because you want to tie yourself to this important event, that's why we have myths, yes, work.
Yes.
It's because we are naturally connective and naturally see coincidence as sign. We are superstitious, faithful, you know, etc. All of those things are wrapped up in us at all the times. So when she sees at this sort of lost and vulnerable point, you know, when she sees these paths, these connective paths, it empowers her in terms of the fact it makes her feel important and compelling. It's also the compelling aspect of having a secret.
Yes, there's a lot that just got said. I feel like the compelling aspect of having a secret is something that makes her feel like she owns something. Something belongs to her. She has discovered something. She is almost the author of something. That is what drives her to actually write the book. So it's all written from the first person. And I wanted her to, in a way, still be mimicking Mizuko, the writer. So Mizuko, the writer, uses her own life in her story. She writes these kind of confessional text, and I think Alice thought, I also will do this because I still want to kind of mimic this woman.
And also she allows herself to do what Mizuko says she does. She can own everything that happens.
Exactly.
Everything in her purview is hers to.
But
to
what
use.
I wanted to. Oh, sneezing cat.
The cat is sneezing.
Actually, Mizuko has a cat quite like that. But I also wanted to, I guess, explore the idea that if you own everything that happens to you, and this is related to what you were saying about myths and that age-old human trait / psychological weakness of wanting to join up with something bigger than yourself, we haven't always been able to do it with the speed and the ease with which we now can. And the way that time and space collapses when you can see what someone's doing in the Bahamas at 4 a.m. and the same time what someone's doing in Egypt at 3 p.m. and what you were doing at that time, and the way that all those lives kind of can converge all at once, I think you have to have an incredibly strong sense of the boundaries of your own self, your own timeline, your own kind of spatial awareness, etc., what's happening to you. And I think if you have anything more porous than that, it's very difficult to kind of steer a course. That obviously, it's good to be open and receptive to the lives of others, but the word sympathy in the title means many different things. But one of those was, what is the line that we should draw between our own stories and the stories of others? How much can we, you know, what's the difference between solidarity and appropriation? How do we kind of maybe cannibalize other people's stories and turn them into our own, and how do we kind of separate ourselves out at the same, you know, keeping those boundaries? I think it has always been the case we wanted to join up with stories larger than ourselves, but it wasn't always the case. We had this piece of like crazy magic in our pockets that enabled us to do that in a kind of sympathy on steroids kind of way, and it doesn't necessarily make us any more connected or any more, you know, aware of others. It seems to actually enable us to just project our own thoughts and feelings onto other people all the time, and vice versa. So I guess I wanted to say it's not inherently bad and it's not necessarily a force for good, but it's definitely something that has shaped the way that our minds work in a way that we haven't yet caught up with.
And especially because I would take that further. Okay, so say the civil rights movements in the 60s, yes, you could join it, but you could join it as sort of a pawn. Alice gets into a situation where not only does she join it, but then she affects it. And by the end of the book, I felt just the publication of the story on her part keeps her in this loop.
Yeah.
And keeps her in this loop of further affecting other people.
Yeah.
Further affecting the people that are hit by that loop. And further and further.
So that ghostly twin of yourself online, which is, you know, I guess that's how trolls sleep at night, is that they're not really the one doing it. It's this persona, etc. But that ghostly self online, which ends up through algorithms and metadata and all that stuff, like nudging your choices, I guess it ends up making some people feel like what they're doing is sort of somehow either predetermined or not their responsibility or doesn't really IRL mean anything real. And I think where Alice gets to at the end, and she's nearly about to step off the ride, nearly about to kind of be able to call time on that, like, loop, as you say, is that she realizes that she has had a real impact on someone who almost seemed peripheral to the story at first. And she realizes that she's been seeing everything through this quite blinkered way and not really taking any form of responsibility for herself, because she didn't almost see herself as existing in the story. She acknowledges up to a point that she has had an effect, but then she's already so addicted almost to that cycle that it's both painful and then yet, like all addictions seem to be, there's this, you know, this negative cycle, this feedback loop almost that happens, whereby that realization makes her feel so despairing, so momentarily guilty, that the only solution is to throw herself back into trying to be a part of Mizuko's life, because it's, you know, the highs and lows sort of follow each other. And I do feel like actually her parents, Alice's adoptive parents' generation, meet during kind of civil rights protests happening on the Columbia campus in New York, and they too are kind of caught up in something which, you know, some people could be drivers of that movement and other people, like you say, were just a part of it because it's systemic. And I definitely did want to look at Alice situated with a kind of power structure, if you like, whether that's technological, social, political. I do feel like she is part of this millennial generation who feel like they are sort of leading the charge, directing, you know, kind of movements from the comfort of their own armchairs, click activism, etc. But actually, they are still pawns in someone else's game, and there's a CEO somewhere, you know, laughing all the way to the bank with every single, you know, online petition they sign.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
The other thing, not the one other thing, because the book comprises so much. Sometimes books try to take on too much, or there is that feeling of everything is connected, but there's too much in there. However, the idea of boundaries and the idea of sexual boundaries and the idea of the internet and sexual boundaries and the idea of because it's there, and therefore, if it's there, it's fine for me to explore.
Mm.
And then that seems to bleed and seems to be more of an issue of it bleeding with consent in person.
Mm. Definitely, I think that there's this sense where she has to justify herself to herself at one point. And I think she feels like her real life has become too risky, too somehow dangerous or unappealing to her. So she wants to be a part of this online life, which is much more easy to curate. You know, at being a kind of app happy generation, we can just tune out things that are displeasing and, you know, focus in on the stuff that we like. We can basically surround ourselves in this little orbit of stuff that puts us at the center and makes us feel more in control. But obviously, if every single person is at the center of that little orbit, what you're not asking is what's displeasing to somebody else, especially, you know, where those two separate online orbits, you know, meet. So there's this scene in which she's just in real life had a kind of rather sort of discomforting, kind of threatening experience with an older man. And she's sort of woken up to discover his hand is on her body, which makes her feel terrible, but also freezes her and makes her feel unable to act, very powerless. And then her almost immediate response when she goes to bed that night is to throw herself into online stalking, going through the pictures without obviously their knowledge or consent. The only consent there is that it's public, so I haven't said no to you specifically, but somehow those images become public property because they're online and because somewhere, you know, when you tick a button that you don't really understand on your Instagram privacy policy, that somehow gives everybody permission to do whatever they want with those images. And I felt like she misses that moment. She doesn't see necessarily or manage to justify why it's okay online. Not that it's exactly the same, it's not completely analogous, but she is affecting some kind of slightly abusive relationship by the end, but online. And it's, and I guess I feel like more and more the distinction between our online and offline selves is increasingly meaningless because we live with the two sort of so converged that you can't really separate out what's okay off and online.
Yeah.
But also that it's very, it lacks policing and it really lacks, you know, other industries have ethical codes. If you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, you have all kinds of, whether it's just a motto or rules to live by, but online, the closest you get is move fast and break things, you know, or do no evil by Google, which is obviously ridiculous. And
well, but also we're seeing that even, I mean, it seems to be similar to the industrial age. If you can get away with it and you're moving faster than the authorities, then it's fine.
You're
and
a maverick.
Good, exactly. Yeah. If it's good for business, and I am speaking about Uber, but if it's good for your business, do it.
Yeah.
And do it, you know, cloak, hide, steal, beg, borrow, whatever.
Mm. And I remember actually once when I was about 18, it's around the age I got my first Facebook account, things like that. We had someone come to talk to my class at school who it was supposed to be a careers talk, and the sort of summary of her talk was, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And I just remember somehow, because her business wasn't necessarily in tech, but it was, you know, I remember just thinking, that is an attitude that is so, so dangerous. And I obviously don't feel like we should, especially with women and especially in the world of business, that everyone should, you know, wait with little nice white folded gloves. But just that kind of, the idea that you can just somehow like repent at a later stage. I feel like that's not going to happen when we are moving this fast. Do you see what I mean? There'll never be a point at which, and also especially with things like the information we put online, the metadata that gets out there, once it's out there you can't take it back. The picture the internet has of you, for better or for worse, whatever it imagines you to be, whether that's a kind of totally accurate representation or a totally warped one, that fixes you online. And I definitely feel like I was born at the very end of 1988, so I'm almost exactly the same age as the internet. But people born just after that, who've never really experienced life offline, you know, to them, it's, God, I would be so devastated if my teens had all been recorded online and there was sort of that skin that I luckily could shed is gone, pretty much. You know, there are some nice analog photos, I'm sure, of me with braces, but other than that, it's gone. And I feel like I feel very sorry for people just a bit younger than me who have got these versions of themselves that they could have evolved past, you know, whether that's in terms of their own, whether it's superficial or it's their own kind of moral stance on stuff. You know, I feel like kids and teenagers do like some pretty bad stuff, and if it's memorialized online, that's so heartbreaking because they don't really get to kind of have a clean slate when they, you know, when they've sort of worked out stuff for themselves. And I feel like Alice, I chose her age quite specifically to be 23 because, yes, she's just graduated, she's not quite sure what to do with herself, and she's on the cusp of potentially kind of developing a bit of a, you know, moral self-awareness. And there is a character who she nearly develops something like kind of, I'd say, meaningful real life connection, which is this grandmother in New York. But just when you hope that that's going to become sort of a kind of solidifying
anchoring,
yes, exactly, some kind of mooring for her, it actually, she ends up partly out of choice and partly nudged away into this totally other path. And like you say, that there is definitely a lot in the book, and I am very much, it was my first book, and I felt like a part of me wanted to write every book in one. But equally, there was method to that sort of way that Alice's path gets sort of shifted and shunted and into something that she never necessarily intended it to be, which I think anyone who has a kind of internet-shaped brain, which is lattice-like rather than linear, can appreciate what that's like. You start off the day meaning to do one thing, and then five sucked Wikipedia trails yeah. later, you're somewhere completely different. And I felt like that was sort of, you know, one of the models I was using for the book was not actually Alice in Wonderland, although I can see why people think that, but Alice Through the Looking Glass, which is all about mirrors and screens and grids and suddenly ending up going backwards and then, you know, all that kind of stuff. I felt like...
And distortions
and the way that, you know, people can see the future and then go backwards and slide up and down this chessboard. I felt like the reason why it's not Wonderland is because in the internet age, we kind of know everything. All information is sort of out there and discoverable. And there's actually a line where Alice is trying to reassure Mizuko about why fiction is still relevant. And it's that, yes, okay, phones tend to kill a plot, but you can still write stories where it's a game of sort of perfect information and every move that can be made is almost visible, if you like. But the problem is knowing what somebody else plans to do and trying to anticipate their moves. So I felt like the story does veer around a bit, back and forth in time, and I wanted that to both reflect the way that the internet works, the way that that's shaped, the way that our mind works, also the way that Alice wants to manipulate and control the story, like you say, have ownership over something. But ultimately also because when every piece of information is already out there, selecting and charting a course through that becomes a case of this, not that, choice here, choice there, like a tree diagram, mm-hmm. you know, and I sort of wanted the story to feel a bit like that.
And it does. And also, just it seems to me that just because the information, the very fact that all the information is out there has created the post-truth
yes.
thing, because you make it all irrelevant. You know, it all has equal weight. And therefore no weight at all.
And so you're just free to choose based on your own kind of exactly. instinctive, emotional, you know, preferences, etc. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, exactly. It becomes, obviously the utopian ideals of the internet making everything democratic and enabling everyone everywhere to access all this information. And that's great, but without any kind of moral framework or without any kind of, you know, this open web has basically made itself open to people who want to exploit that. Mm-hmm. And even Tim Berners-Lee, who obviously created the internet, he this year has sort of developed his own platform, which is sort of about reclaiming what the internet was initially supposed to do, trying to steer
good luck
it back.
With that.
Well, exactly, good luck with that. It's one of those things that's slightly, you know...
Genie out of the bottle, babe.
Exactly. And I think that thing, too, of genie out of the bottle was a part of where Alice originally felt like she's in control of the story, and then these sort of postscripts happen, which she's not really able to control. So it was about, I guess, at the end, the way that she tries to wield control over the story and give it her own kind of shape and stamp. And the way that she struggles to do that was intentional, because I feel like that's something, you know, that people right now are definitely struggling to do in this political moment, is to kind of shape the narrative.
I was going to say, my suggestion would be get out of the house and just walk out.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's where, you know, there are moments when you kind of almost feel like she might be back on the straight and narrow, glimmers of hope. She, at the end, she decides her kind of maybe her job might be being a gardener. She might set up a company called New Leaf Gardening and spend all her time kind of tilling the soil and creating little sort of herbaceous borders, but she doesn't really make that work. It's a slightly superficial image making act.
But I definitely feel that way, that like you can just say, you know, like, oh, I'm a filmmaker because you have a phone, I'm a this because you have a phone. Okay, but tell me about because you hadn't written before.
No, so I'd written short stories mm-hmm. when I was sort of still at school, 18, and then I went to university straight away, didn't take any time out to read English, and in a way that almost not killed, but I spent a lot of time almost behind the scenes with works of fiction, taking them apart, seeing how they worked, and that didn't actually make me want to write my own. It made me sort of feel like for the first 3 or 4 years after I graduated, I actually only wanted to read nonfiction. I'd sort of had my, you know, almost like overexposure.
So you've seen them, all the moving parts behind it, it seemed artificial.
The mechanics, and mm-hmm. I felt like I could only deal with what was real. And actually that did obviously still shape Sympathy, because I very much wanted it to feel like it could, at least at the beginning, all have happened for real. It was very much set with real news reports, real dates, mm-hmm. real, you know, real world things. And yet, I was working at, when I decided to write it, I was working at a consultancy, so I'd graduated 5 years before, and I was doing a kind of a pitch, so like a little slideshow basically, which was supposed to be very kind of pithy. And my boss, I used maybe like 4 words on one slide instead of one, and my boss sort of said to me, kindly, but I think a bit, she said, "This is Baroque." And I remember thinking, oh yes, I used to like writing fiction. And I think everyone often sort of has to go away for a bit from the thing that they really love to get a bit of space and distance and remember why it is that that's specifically your thing, the thing that you love. So I definitely hadn't written anything novel length, and I didn't do any kind of creative writing courses or a master's or anything like that. I just sort of started. I was lucky actually though, because I managed to meet the woman who then became my agent quite early on in the process, and I sort of basically used her almost as a mentor figure. So she would say, get me 3 chapters by this date, and I would send it to her in serial. And it felt, you know, I think everyone needs to have someone like that
pulling it out of you,
making it happen, because otherwise you'd just go to bed every night being like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? But she, you know, she really kind of made it feel like a project that was worth pursuing. And then, yeah, I quit my job. I took a sabbatical and then I quit. And then I edited it with my editors in the US and the UK. So it took about 2 years to do in total. And I think it was sort of written in a fever dream, which I think...
A fugue state.
Yeah, I think it's sort of... You can sense that when you read it, but I think that kind of works.
Yeah, I mean, because that becomes Alice's...
Yeah,
you know.
Which I think now is funny, because obviously I hope to... Well, I've got, you know, the sort of bare bones of another one on my laptop at the moment. And it's quite strange, because it's... I want it to be very different. I'm not going to write in the first person again. But whilst I'm still, you know, synonymous with or in a one-to-one ratio with this one book, I sort of feel like it's almost like me, you yeah. know, like this weird version of me, and I can't wait to write another one. So
this ghost version
exactly,
of you.
Exactly, because I think it did actually also shape mm-hmm. me a bit whilst
of
writing
course.
It. It made me question my own, you know, relationships. It made me question my relationship with the internet. It definitely made me think about myself. Mm-hmm. In weird ways, which I think if you're spending 2 years working on anything, it would be sad if it
didn't have any effect at all.
Exactly, just water off a duck's back.
Kind of like, whoosh!
What was that? No, I think it definitely shaped me almost as much as I wrangled it under control by the end. But it was one of those great moments, I think, maybe exactly halfway through the book. I had a deadline to finish it by for my agent, and I was writing by... I planned it all, so I knew exactly what was coming, and I was writing maybe a chapter per day for the last month, and or like, you know, for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I reached this point where I'd been awake for about, you know, 24 hours, and I had all the coffee, and I was alone in this very remote, rural, like, cottage, where I'd sort of taken myself off to eliminate distractions, and I wrote this chapter which hasn't been edited at all, like not a single word got touched.
Wow.
And I just felt like, this is why I'm doing this. This is the feeling that I want to get again, and I really hope I can get it again with my next one, because people say that, well, you know, difficult second album,
yeah.
but that people say that you don't have the same unself-consciousness when you write your next one, because the first one you write it thinking, maybe no one will ever read this except for me, but that's kind of great. Yeah. And so, yeah, I wrote this one chapter, which is sort of, it's like a drug. I want to get that feeling back again.
You have made a rod for your own back, because it is a phenomenal book.
Thank you.
And I think it will get a lot of attention. So.
No, it's very exposing in a similar way, I guess, yes. to the way that, you know, the internet exposes us. But it's a very strange and very new feeling, but I hope exciting.
Well, it was an exciting read and very thought-provoking. And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And I'm really looking forward to your second book myself.
Oh, great. Well, now I've got a reason to write it.
There you go. I'm pulling it out.
It's funny because speaking about it is strange because it's sort of almost like, more like therapy.
Yeah, I imagine, yes.
It's like, oh, I didn't really know I was thinking about like that, but turns out I do.
Thank you so much,
Olivia. No problem.
Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you. Can't you see there's no other man above you? What a wicked way to treat the girl that loves you. Oh love, they don't love you like I love you. Oh down, they don't love you like I love you. Something don't feel right, because it ain't right, especially coming up after midnight. I smell your secrets, and I'm not too perfect to ever feel this worthless. How did it come down to this? Scrolling through your call list. I don't wanna lose my bride, but I'ma fuck me up a bitch. Know that I kept it sexy, and know I kept it fun. There's something that I'm missing, maybe my head for one. What's worst, looking jealous or crazy? Jealous or crazy? Or like being walked all over lately? Walked all over lately, I'd rather be crazy. Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you. Can't you see there's no other man above you? What a wicked way to treat the girl that loves you. Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Let's imagine for a moment that you never made a name for yourself, a master wealth, they had you labeled as a king. Never made it out the cage, still out there moving in them streets. Never had the baddest woman in the game up in your sheets. Would they be down to ride now? They used to hide from you, lie to you, but y'all know we were made for each other. So I find you and hold you down. Missing, say, hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you. Can't you see there's no other man above you? What a wicked way to treat the girl that loves you. Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. It's such a shame you let this good love go to waste. I always keep the top tier, 5-star, sexy loving in the car, like make that wood, holly like a boulevard. What's worse, looking jealous or crazy, jealous and crazy? Or like being walked all over lately, walked all over lately, I'd rather be crazy. Hold up, they don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up, they don't love you like I love you. Step down, they don't love you like I love you. Can't you see there's no other man above you? What a wicked way to treat the girl that loves you. Oh love, they don't love you like I love you. Oh down, they don't love you like I love you. I'm up on my bed and get my swag on. I look in the mirror, say what's up. What's up, what's up, what's up? I hop up off my bed and get my swag on. I look in the mirror, say what's up. What's up, what's up, what's up?
RadioGorgeous.com